Current State on 90.5 WKAR, and our live music today is brought to us by Dearborn's Jeff Karub. By day, Jeff is a reporter for the Associated Press, so if that name seems like it rings a bell, that's the reason why. You've seen the byline probably around Michigan. But he's also a singer-songwriter and the creator of Coming Home to Music, the Coming Home to Music Project, which was recently awarded a Knight Foundation grant to put on a series of house concerts in Detroit. So we'll be hearing from Jeff a little bit more throughout the hour, and we'll be talking with him later this hour as well. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last night, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder offered his annual reckoning of state affairs in his fourth State of the State address. He encouraged action this year on immigration, more support for state schools, among other issues. He also called for more to be done for the state's working people, claimed he was open to the idea of a tax cut, and called for the legislature to get behind a balanced budget amendment in Washington. Two guests join me to explore what the governor's address means. WKAR-TV's Tim Skubick, who covers the State of the State annually with the Off the Record panelist, joins me this morning. Welcome back.
Morning, Mark. Felt like we're doing Prairie Home Companion here.
It did kind of have
thanks, Garrison.
Had that vibe to it for just a second. Coming up, the news from Lake Wobegon.
There you go.
And we're also pleased to be joined by our special guest, Democratic Senate Majority Leader Gretchen Whitmer of East Lansing. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. I love the live music. It's cool.
It happens just about every Friday now here on Current State. Tim, your panelists last night on television didn't rate the governor's speech highly. Mostly, I think you gave him a scale of 10, and most of the ratings fell in the three to five range, but in an election year, was anyone realistically expecting anything really groundbreaking or intense?
Look, for him, he gets a 10, because it was basically his object there was to provide a launching pad for his reelection bid. I think this speech should have been called the State of My Reelection Bid rather than the State of the State. There was very little on the State of the State and very lots, if you will, if that's the correct phraseology, on all the good things that he has done. And you know what? Give him credit for taking advantage of the opportunity. The reason governors, and this one included, love the State of the State is they get an hour, in this case about 65 minutes of unfiltered, uncensored, combobulated by the news media to talk directly to the people. And you know what? Every governor does it in their last term running for reelection. I'm going to tell you what I did and see what a good boy am I.
Mm-hmm. Why'd you only give him a 4.5 then?
Well, I think from a journalistic standpoint, first of all, there was very little in it. Okay, it was an hour into the speech before, as a journalist, I said, whoop, there's something I can write about. The possibility, as his term was, an opportunity for some tax relief. That was, for me, the hard news lead out of the speech.
Should we put Senator Whitmer on the line and ask her to give it a 0 to 10 rating?
Oh, geez, that's hard to do. You know, I have served with three different governors. This is the 14th State of the State that I've sat in the gallery and listened to. And I do think for the governor, it was his best delivery, yet he seems to have gotten more comfortable over the last couple years.
Yeah.
But I will say in terms of substance, it was very flat. There was not much there. Where he did talk about things that I'm really interested in, and I think the people of Michigan are, like education, it was complete malarkey to say that there's been a $660 per pupil increase to our schools. Well, every superintendent across the state had to be scratching their heads, and every teacher and parent, too.
Where did that number come from?
That number is actually a number that we are legally obligated to put into retirement. Those dollars have not gone into the classroom at all. In fact, under Snyder, there's been a $470 cut per pupil in his first year. He threw $30 back at the kids 2 years later, but that's a net $440 per pupil cut from students since the first day he took office. So to say that there's an increase was complete.
Well, you think governor made the point, though, in the speech, and not to defend him, but his point was even though that money went into the pensions and the retirement, that freed up other dollars that could, through the back door, get into the classroom. You're not buying that argument at all.
not at all. And, you know,
well, isn't a savings here? Can it be put over there?
Sure, Tim, but if you've got a legal obligation and you're going to try to tell the people that these dollars are going into the classroom, that's just baloney. I'm one of the parents who is in the public schools every single day with my kids. I know their class sizes have exploded. Their teachers are struggling just to get through the day, much less to make sure that they're getting the top-notch education that we need in order to have the dynamic workforce that's going to lure job providers here to Michigan and have degree holders, which kind of bleeds into his immigration stuff, if you want to start talking about that.
Let's listen to another schooling recommendation the governor made last night.
What happens to young people, particularly lower income or in distressed or lower performing schools, because of summer vacation? There's evidence out there to show that they can lose much of what they learn because they're not actively in learning mode. I think it would be appropriate to look at a pilot for low performing schools about can we support them to look at year-round school to help give those kids every chance to be successful.
Gretchen Whitmer, what about year-round school? Is it time for greater emphasis on that?
I think that's something we certainly should have a debate about, but I don't know that it makes sense to talk about doing brand new initiatives across the state when we've got such dire circumstances because of the bleeding that's been happening to the schools. You know, this governor has taken $2 billion out of the school aid fund. That's the only reason we have a surplus that he was patting himself on the back about last night, is because they stole that money out of the schools and they started taxing pensions. So we've got real fundamental things to do in our schools before we start talking about expanding policy and programming. But you know, that being said, I do think that that's a debate that we should have, and it should be robust and transparent, and we should think about it.
So was there more to like or more to dislike in the governor's speech as far as education is concerned?
I think more to dislike. I was shocked that there was absolutely no mention of higher education. You know, education is economic development, and degree holders, number of degree holders directly is related to prosperity of a state. I think in 14 states of the states, I don't think I've ever been to one where a governor didn't even mention a higher education investment and the import. He did make a comment about, a university in the UP, but as far as higher education and moving our state forward in degree holders, his only initiative was importing immigrants.
The governor eventually got around to the $1 billion, or nearly $1 billion surplus that Michigan has accrued in what sounded to me like one of the more serious moments in the address. Mr. Snyder made the following point regarding tax relief.
When I talk about tax relief, the people that come to mind in particular are those hardworking Michiganders that get up every day, they pack their lunch to go to work, they work hard all day, they come home tired, and when after they get home, they're worried about their bills. I don't think we can solve all their issues, but we can help.
Gretchen Whitmer, what do you think that means?
I don't know. That's a very open-ended thing to say. We should give people tax relief. Well, I would submit that the best thing that we can do to relieve the tax burden on people is to undo the Republican tax increases of the last couple years. You know, tax cuts in and of themselves, like some of my colleagues in the legislature are promoting, aren't going to do anything to turn the economy around if you're just giving a few cents a day to someone in the form of an income tax rebate. But if you got rid of the pension tax, that could mean a huge difference to our seniors. That's something that would make
sense.
Any
middle ground there, though, short of a wholesale reversal of the pension tax and the other more recent tax increases this administration has enacted and that your party wants reversed, is there any middle ground there? Realistically, what might happen?
Well, if we could talk about something like the Earned Income Tax Credit, that would be meaningful to people, and that would be money that gets spent right back into the economy. But if we're talking about a overall rollback on the income tax, you know, tax cuts don't create economic growth, and they don't generate sufficient jobs to ensure economic opportunity for all if you're just talking about a few cents a day in an income tax rollback. What we really need to talk about is an investment. Investment is the way that you get your economy moving and that you grow the workforce that ultimately draws jobs into the state. That's the best thing that we can do.
We are getting an early childhood investment.
We are.
I'm
the
sure
question is, where is it coming from?
I imagine you're pleased with that.
I am. We talk about immigration. I'm pleased that he says he wants Michigan to be open to all. That is something I can endorse. I am pleased when he talks about an early childhood investment. But the question is, in the detail, do those dollars come, is that more money that he's going to take away from the school aid fund? Because that's how we paid for the early childhood investment last time around. This is not a new investment in education. It's stealing from one child to pay for another's education. That's not a long-term solution, and that's not the vision of how we move Michigan forward.
Here's the governor's conundrum on the tax issue. I think if we applied some truth serum to him, he would say, let's hang on to this money. Okay, I thought he teed up his statement about the opportunity for a tax increase with a preamble that said, we got a lot of other stuff to do, like stock some of it away in the savings account, putting off some of the things that we should have been spending on. Maybe we ought to do that, and that's maybe where higher education comes in, but he didn't mention that by name. And he said if we were sitting around the table, we would take about taking care of our mortgage and our long-term debt. Well, that was code for boys and girls out there in the legislature, and his quote was, it's not about politics. Guess what? It is. Okay. But he's trying to tamp down this fever about cutting taxes and be fiscally responsible. Remember, this guy's a CPA. He knows that you can't give all the money back, and you have to wisely do it prudently. But yet politically, and here's his challenge, he has to appease the beast out there with everybody running for reelection in the House and Senate to do something to so they can go back home and say, look what we did for you. So finding that middle ground, the administration, I don't believe, wants to do a tax rollback. The Jack Brandenburg bill in the Senate, I think, is on life support. All right. But maybe a rebate. But you also have the question, how much is it? I talked to Nixon, the budget director, the other day. He said, you know, if it's too small, it'll cost us more to administer it than the actual tax relief. So, you know, this is not a clear shot towards a tax cut. The governor opened the door, but he didn't walk through it.
Gretchen Whitmer, how do you feel that other Republicans might approach? Are they going to be more intent on getting an income tax cut out there on the table and discussed?
I'm not sure. You know, there are a whole lot of different theories going on right now, and I don't think they're all on the same page right now with regard to what it means in terms of a tax relief, what that should look like. So, you know, I know that
Tim thinks it's on life support, though. I mean, would you go that far?
Well, Tim's kind of extreme. I don't know if you've noticed that about him over the years, but
I've been called a lot of things, but never extreme.
I don't know if it's on life support or not. You know, those are conversations I think that are going to evolve. But I think the governor's got going to have a hard time this year. We've got enormous issues to tackle, whether it is, you know, issues revolving the Detroit bankruptcy. I think there are a lot of tough issues ahead of us, and he's going to have a hard time with his own party.
If I may, the two chairs, the Republican chair of the House Appropriations Committee and the Republican chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee have said, we don't like a tax rollback. Those are pretty two influential people. Okay. And we add to that John Nixon. I stand by my statement, and I will accept your apology after we find out that there is no rollback.
He wants to increase the rainy day fund more. There's if memory serves, there's $580 million in it now. Is that a legitimate target for some of this surplus, Gretchen?
You know, I would submit that the surplus is money that they stole from our schools, and that's exactly where the money should be going.
Another more notable segment last night involved immigration, which we touched on earlier. Let's listen to that.
I'm going to sign an executive order creating the Michigan Office for New Americans to be a coordinating resource to say, let's welcome these individuals to encourage entrepreneurship, to encourage those students that are getting those advanced degrees in engineering not to have to leave the country but to stay and grow companies and employ Michiganders. If someone has the opportunity to come to our country legally, let's hold our arms open and say, come to Michigan. This is the place to be.
Gretchen Whitmer, let's revisit that a little bit. What do you make of that proposal?
I think that's a great sentiment, and that's something that I wholeheartedly believe, and I think people on my side of the aisle would embrace that. The problem here is that every state of the state, he's talked a little bit about immigration. But it gets undercut. His rhetoric is undercut every time he signs the intolerant legislation that gets to his desk sent by his Republican friends in the legislature, like cutting same-sex benefits for people in this state. You know, every time you say you want to be a welcoming state to people and then you send that message out to the world, it's got a chilling effect on people looking to come to the state of Michigan. And I think, frankly, talking about importing degree holders really is strange when we've got so many kids in Michigan who can't afford that higher education degree but want it, but are qualified to get it. We should be doing, he talks about economic gardening, we should be doing educational gardening and growing degree holders here in Michigan who are going to stay here in Michigan and help kids afford that college degree and get that degree and stay right here. That's what would be great for our economy. We don't need to import degree holders. We need to help Michigan kids get degrees.
The governor has touched on immigration before, Tim. Is 2014 going to be different?
Well, he's going to create an office. That was one of the few initiatives, new initiatives, in what I thought was a pretty much stand pat state of the state message. So create a new office to do this. You know, no points off for suggesting it. The impact that it has is questionable, and we'll see.
Let's listen to the comment from the governor here that again, if memory serves, got the loudest approval last night.
I think it's about time that we let Washington know that we know how to do things right in Michigan. There are two or three topics we could say that about. We can say it about tax reform. We can say it about paying our long-term debt. We can say it about balanced budgets. But I am making a request here tonight because it involves you, the legislators, both the House and the Senate, that I ask you to take up the issue of doing a resolution asking the United States government to include in the United States Constitution an amendment to say they have to balance their budget.
Can I just point out that a resolution is probably not worth the paper that it's written on? I don't know how many resolutions are sent to Washington in the year. It must be millions. And as for this having an impact on the debate in Washington, I think it's a wash. But it was a nice piece of red meat for conservative Republicans. That's why they were yucking it up. And why not play to them? Hey, you got a chance, play to the grandstands.
What do you make of it, Senator Whitmer?
I mean, I think Skubik's spot on this one.
You not know, extreme on that one, am I?
it struck me as a complete political pandering to the right on the Republican side.
It does play into a larger national debate, though.
But he says he's not about national debates. You know, I ask him questions on national issues, and he gives me the answer all the time. I don't deal with national issues. Well, there he was dealing with that.
He does periodically say that is quite forthcoming in saying that Washington is broken.
He does say that.
But
I think also, you know, it was kind of hard to stomach when he said, oh, they should balance their budgets like we do. That's such baloney. Our budget, the governor's budget for the current year, is still not balanced. They got it done on time, but we have a $130 million hole because of the claims tax problems that they can't get through. We've got a $70 million hole because he couldn't get two votes out of the Republican Senate to give immediate effect to the Medicaid expansion. So his budget is not balanced. So to say Washington needs to learn from us, our budget isn't even balanced. And frankly, balanced budget amendments, I think people should really be very leery of it. It's one of those things like the Patriot Act. It sounds good, but in practice, it could be very dangerous. We wouldn't have a land-grant university if they had balanced budgets back in the days of when Michigan State was founded.
Yeah, you could also make the argument, though, to have a healthy and robust debate on this, and I don't think you would oppose that.
Oh, I embrace all debate, Tim.
Can we quote you on that?
Doesn't it play, though, to a lot of the working and middle-class constituency that you're trying to appeal to, though? Families who contend with spending and taxes around the kitchen table?
Exactly.
Imagery is pretty powerful.
Imagery is powerful, and that's why I likened it to the Patriot Act. It's one of those things that sounds really good, like Leave No Child Left Behind. But when you talk about what it really means, I think that's where people should be getting educated and should be very concerned about it.
Tim, several of your guests last night used a phrase to describe the upcoming election campaign we're facing. They predicted a class warfare campaign and election. Are you anticipating that?
Well, let's frame this debate this way. The Democrats are playing this card. I'm going to count the number of times that Democrats this year say middle class, okay, because they have polling data, particularly on the pension tax issue, that this resonates very well. They can make some political hay on trying to talk about seniors paying this pension tax. And so they're going to put all the common folks on one side, and the rhetoric that Ms. Whitmer and others are using against the governor is he's for the wealthy, his corporate cronies, giving them this $1.8 billion tax cut at the average person's. That is the storyline between now and next November. The question is, Are the voters going to buy it? It will be interesting to see how the governor tries to inoculate himself. He had some stuff in the speech about senior citizens, but I don't think that that takes the edge off of the pension tax. I think the Democrats are onto something here. They're going to exploit it, and they're going to play one side against the other.
Gretchen Whitmer, within the past few weeks, you were approached by UAW President Bob King to reconsider running for governor. How did you respond to that when he proposed that?
I'll tell you, you know, I announced over a year ago that I was not going to be throwing my hat into that race, that I endorsed Mark Schauer immediately. And, you know, I've got a lot of balls in the air, and two of them are my children, Sherry and Sydney, with whom I really am only have seven more years with them at home, and that's my top priority right now is where I need to spend my time.
It must be exasperating, though, as a party leader to have such a constituency have significant doubts about your candidate. How destructive was this episode?
I think it's, we all just want to turn the page, frankly. I think Mark has got all the right values. I think he is going to be a strong opponent for the governor, and I'm excited to be supporting him.
I thank our two guests for an excellent discussion, Senator Gretchen Whitmer and WKAR-TV's Tim Skubick. Now go catch something, go shoot something.
Have a good time.
Fall comes early around here. Air is crisp, but it's clear. It's time that you know that everything grows back, but fall comes early around here. Yeah, fall comes early around here. Dogs bark as loud over there. Boy licks a fence on a dare. Slick roads, a car crash. Old man gets whiplash, but fall comes early around here. Yeah, fall comes early around here.
States on 90.5 WKAR. We're enjoying music today from Dearborn's Jeff Karub. Jeff is a reporter for the Associated Press in Detroit by day, but he's a singer-songwriter by night and the creator of Coming Home to Music Project, which was recently awarded a Knight Foundation grant. And we'll talk with Jeff and hear more of his music coming up. How do you make science fun and approachable for youth? You use hip-hop. That's the theory behind the project Science Genius Battles. Battles is an acronym. Bring attention to transforming teaching, learning, and engagement in science. Battles. The Battles are the brainchild of Dr. Christopher Emden and Wu-Tang Clan member GZA. Emden serves as an associate professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at Columbia University's Teachers College. And this week he spoke as part of the MSU Department of Education's CREATE Science Seminar Series. WKAR's Emmanuel Berry sat down with Emden, and she joins us in the studio now. Emmanuel, tell us more about Science Genius.
Well, this was the first year that they did it. It was a pilot project, and kids throughout all of New York, their school system wrote and performed raps covering topics like cell division, gravity, DNA, just these really kind of difficult concepts, and made these absolutely amazing raps out of them. And beyond working to make science education fun and approachable to you through the Science Genius Battles, Emden, he also focuses his work about just connecting with youth culture in general and also expanding upon the hip-hop ed social media movement. Mm. Hip-hop ed is a Twitter hashtag. And anyone who wants to learn more about hip-hop and education and how they can use them together is welcome to kind of go to this hashtag and start a conversation and ask questions. So it's a really interesting hip-hop education movement there. But hip-hop, it wasn't always central to Emden's education strategies. He explains that he was once a very traditional teacher.
I remember my first job was in a middle school in New York City. And the first thing I wanted to do was teach like every other teacher that I had. You know, I figured that was the way to do it. So I'd teach like they taught, but I'd be cool enough where they'd want to learn stuff from me. And that I learned rather quickly that I wasn't that cool. And then I got to a juncture where I got frustrated with teaching in the middle school, and I helped to start a small high school in New York City because I just wanted to do things differently. And in that school, at that school, Marie Curie High School in the Bronx, I really started thinking about how to be more creative with teaching, how to be more, how to take more risks, you know, how to do things that may not be seen as the norm, but I knew would capture the interests of young people. And that, you know, over time evolved into utilizing youth culture as the anchor for instruction. And that part came just from seeing kids outside of class just super engaged and excited, you know, their eyes lighting up and, you know, laughing and, you know, just like talking back and forth to each other and engaged, and then seeing those same kids in classrooms like falling asleep and bored. And I was like, there's something that's going on out there that I've got to be able to use. Yeah, there's got to be something different that I can employ from what they do outside of the classroom to bring into the classroom. And that kind of tells the story of my evolution as an educator.
What is wrong with that traditional approach that you started out with? I mean, why do teachers fail to kind of engage students and in particular in science?
Well, you know, traditional approaches to teaching and learning do work in certain spaces. They work when you're dealing with populations whose ways of knowing and being are aligned to those modes of instruction. So if I come from a two-parent family where I grow up seeing mom reading the newspaper and dad reading a book on his free time, and things are structured so we go to family events together and we sit together at the dining table, the nature of that kind of structured experience, that upper white middle class experience, it aligns to modes of traditional instruction. And for populations who are from backgrounds that are more traditional, mm-hmm. traditional instruction works. The problem with the field of education is that we are dealing with a wide array of people with a wide array of cultures, with various backgrounds, with different socioeconomic classes. And so we cannot expect a generic approach to teaching and learning to work for everyone. The nature of teaching and learning has to accommodate different populations based on what they need to be engaged. You know, one of my favorite sayings is that students are different. The issue is to understand that different does not mean deficient. It mm-hmm. just means that the nature of the instruction has to vary to match the cultural dispositions, the cultural needs, the cultural experiences of different populations.
A lot of your teaching focuses on kind of this idea of understanding the youth culture,
Absolutely.
Of understanding what that is. Explain what you mean by youth culture in that sense.
I mean, youth culture is, it's understanding that by virtue of being, you know, between 6 and 18 or 19, there's a certain way that you look at the world. Mm-hmm. There's a certain way that you experience the world. It's very different from the ways that those who are older do. And, you know, also, there's a certain piece of youth identity that cannot be captured by folks who are not experiencing the same things they are. There's something about that youthful angst. There's something about that youthful frustration. There's something about the altruistic nature of just caring about other people mm-hmm. that adulthood sort of forces you to lose, you know? And I think that if teachers or parents even, I mean, my work, people oftentimes view it as, you know, this guy tells folks how to make education differently for teachers in schools. You know, I think my research and my experiences are more of ways to engage with young people to get them to expand their possibilities. That's applicable to teachers, but also to parents and also to folks in faith ministries, et cetera. It's about mm-hmm. understanding the nuances of the culture of young people. So, and in youth culture is understanding all those dynamics, you know, where they are developmentally, where they are culturally, where they are experientially, and most importantly, what forms of culture are attuned to their ways of knowing and being. Like, mm-hmm. what are they listening to and why are they listening to it?
What are they listening to? What is connecting with them culturally?
Music-wise, you know, I find that hip-hop is the culture of young people, even if they don't listen to hip-hop music. And there's mm-hmm. it's a big difference between hip-hop music and hip-hop culture. I think hip-hop culture is Americana. I think youth who listen to rock music, who listen to country music, who listen to, you know, soft ballads are part of a hip-hop generation. Because what's happened with hip-hop is that hip-hop as a cultural art form has infiltrated all forms of music. And you'll
it's
find,
global.
Yeah, you find hip-hop elements in everything. And so hip-hop, to me, it's the crux of youth culture. The music, the art, the ways of dress, the ways of knowing, the ways of seeing, being, experiencing the world. So understanding hip-hop means understanding youth culture.
When I think of science, I remember my science classes in high school. I took physics and biology and all that kind of thing. And I remember them kind of being these really experiences that were very objective. Like, there's an answer.
Yep.
And I have to... And that's it. Like, I have to get to that answer, whatever that is. And then if it changes at all, it's just another answer that then I have to get to that answer. And
God,
being
what a shame.
Kind of removed in a sense. Yeah. And here you're taking hip hop, which is, you know, this creativity and this flow and this playfulness to it. And I'm just like, how do we get these to work together? So, how do these seemingly very different things become kind of cohesive to teach and engage students?
You know, like what you describe as seemingly variant is that's a piece that gets me, because science is so different than the way that science is taught in schools. I mean, when I think about science, I think about science when I was in schools, and I can describe it the same way that you described it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think about science and how scientists make sense of the world, oh my God, it's beautiful. It is hip hop. There is
it
flow.
Is
oh, absolutely.
All right.
Scientists are posing questions about the universe, about what they observe, and then they're going out there and finding out how and why what they think works or does not work. Scientists are going out there and sharing information with a body of other people who are also scientists and trying to convince them that the ideas work. That's not about an answer.
Mm-hmm.
That's about convincing folks. That's about being creative and how you come up with ideas and conjecture, you know, how you theorize concepts and how you take ideas that already existed and you remix them. You know, and try to recreate and rehash them. You know, science is about who can ask the most profound questions. And science is not about finding the right answer. Not at all.
Okay.
Science is about asking the right questions. The most prolific scientists of our time have been those who were able to ask questions that people before them didn't think. They weren't the people who gave us the finite answers. I think we've been conditioned to believe that science is this objectivist discipline, when in reality, it's very subjective. I mean, think about... You know, a scientist in a laboratory does not conduct an experiment on something that he's not interested in. You know, you have to be passionate about it first.
Yeah.
And so I think hip hop and science are so closely related. I explore these concepts in my book. So in Urban Science Education for the Hip Hop Generation, I talk about hip hop culture and I talk about science as well. But I also talk about the fact that hip hop and science are so deeply attuned. I mean, hip hop artists speak in metaphor and analogy, and they use artistic interpretations to make sense of the environment. I mean, you know, how is that different from what a research scientist does? I think there's a big difference between school science and actual science. And unfortunately, the nature of school science is completely antithetical to the nature of science. And if we can teach young people what science truly is, they'll realize that who they are is actually synonymous with being a scientist.
And one of the ways you've tried to do that is with the project you launched last year. It's called Science Genius Battles, which stands for Bring Attention to Transforming Teaching, Learning, and Engagement in Science.
Yes.
Tell us about this project. It's really cool.
Well, you know, the Science Genius Battles is a partnership with rap icon GZA from the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yeah.
And GZA is a science enthusiast. You know, he's a guy who always wanted to be a scientist. Before he wanted to be a rapper, he wanted to be a scientist. And all along, throughout his career, he's sort of incorporated science rhymes and you know, science concepts into his lyrical repertoire. And so Science Genius Battles is an effort to make the 10th grader that GZA was before he left school and decided to be a hip hopper to stay in science.
Mm-hmm.
And to do so, we began with 10 New York City public schools. We spoke to the teachers and we spoke to the principals and said, listen, we just want to come in here and give kids another way of showcasing their knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And these are kids who are deeply immersed in hip hop culture across New York City public schools. So instead of writing an assignment at the end or going and answering some boring questions at the end of class, we want them to be able to go home and write raps about the science content that they're learning in school and that are required on the state exams anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, all we're doing is giving you guys a different tool to assess this knowledge. And, you know, they said, what if the kids can't rap? if they can't rap, have them write a rhyme anyway, because writing a rhyme helps them to learn the information anyway. Do you realize the deep intellectual process that goes into, one, understanding the information, grasping that concept, and then being able to write a story about it, and then making sure that story rhymes? Everybody benefits from writing raps. And so we have the kids go out there in these schools, and they all write raps. And in each of the schools, there's a science battle. In hip-hop, the art of the battle is when you have two MCs facing off and they're rapping about each other's lives and families and mothers, and if I have more money than you, and if I...
Playing the dozens.
You know, they're essentially playing the dozens.
Yeah.
And so a science genius battle is kids doing... They're writing raps about science concepts and battling each other for who knows the most science content. Then we have a representative from each of the schools who is like the winner, almost following the model of the National Scripps Spelling Bee, right? So you have the spelling bee champion of your school. We have the science genius rapper of the school. And then each of the kids who rap in the school, who wins the competition, we brought them down to Columbia University, a teacher's college, and we had a citywide battle.
Yeah.
Oh, man, it was intense. You know, we had students from each of the schools coming there to represent their friends. We had scientists and rappers on stage judging. And the kids all performed, and the judges went and deliberated, and then they selected the one winner. And the one winner is a New York City science genius.
I want to take a listen to the winner now. That was Jabari Johnson, and his song was called Quest for Jewelry.
Yes.
A play on the measurement unit of jewels.
Be a man, understand you comprehending this is vital work equals FD, the equation for survival. Your only rival is friction. Don't get caught up in the drag. You better prepare, because obstacles fight back. When you get knocked down, no, please don't cry. Just get up and apply more force next time. One day.
That was Quest for Jewelry, the winner of the science genius battles. That was, I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. Listening to that is absolutely amazing. And it's, I mean, just the from the lyrical standpoint alone, and then the content.
Yeah.
I mean, what was the process like? What did it take for students to get to that point?
So let me tell you this. I mean, Jabari won, but there were some gifted young people mm-hmm. who were brilliant. And when I say gifted young people, they were kids who were in the schools who, you know, didn't win the school battle. But, you know, it's like, you know how in the spelling bee, you miss one letter?
You're done?
Yeah. There are kids who just missed being the representative from their school because of one slip up, of one factual scientific, you know, detail or factoid that was lost. So the level of brilliance of young people, once given the opportunity to express their knowledge and their passion for learning in a different way, is mind-boggling.
You mentioned earlier that you're working on a book. Any other upcoming projects for you?
Yeah. So, you know, first and foremost is Science Genius is growing. Science Genius is hopefully going to be expanded to more cities across the United States. I'm looking to bring Science Genius to some major spaces in Michigan, hopefully. You know, thinking about Science Genius Detroit and what that might look like. Science Genius Atlanta. We have Science Genius New York. Science Genius South Africa. So that's growing. My new book, Reality Pedagogy. It's really talking about, you know, how to teach, focus on the reality of youth experiences by giving teachers really practical tools. I'm finally finishing it. It should be out this time next year. Jabari Johnson, winner of Science Genius, is going to be releasing it's called a Science Genius EP, which is a five song album based on science concepts. And then, you know, hip hop ed as a movement is growing. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, I wake up in the morning and I get emails from folks who are saying, you know, we tried this thing that we got on the hip hop ed hashtag and it's making this kind of difference in my classroom. You know, I get emails from kids saying, thank you for making me know I'm a scientist. And so I know I've stumbled upon something great. And then with a partnership with an icon like GZA, I mean, who is not just like a celebrity, you know, endorser. And this is important to note. You know, this is a guy who really believes in the power of hip hop and education. You know, this is a multi-platinum selling artist who comes into New York City public schools mm-hmm. and coaches kids on rapping, you know, and performs for them, you know, and, you know, you'll see this, you know, this big icon sit, you know, kids are sitting and he's on his knee, you know, looking them in the eye and telling them that they can do this. And that's essentially all the things that I'm working on. I have my hands full.
Yeah.
But it's just the most amazing and gratifying work anyone can do.
Chris Hemden, thank you so much for stopping by and chatting.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here. And, you know, I look forward to having your audience join us on Hip Hop Ed. Even if you're not completely convinced about this being you know, the best thing for your kid, to be a part of the conversation, because we can't move the agenda forward without having some dialogue about it. And on social media, we can have that dialogue.
Christopher Emden is an associate professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at the Teachers College at Columbia University. He also currently serves as the Caperton Fellow and Hip Hop Archive Fellow at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard University. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Our live music here in Studio S today has been performed by Dearborn's Jeff Karub. Jeff is a reporter for the Associated Press in Detroit by day, but after hours, it's a different thing. He's a singer-songwriter. Let's listen to Jeff's Made by Motown.
State, the other across the sea. Both took a shot at achieving their dreams by assembling Model Ts. 5,000 parts and $5 a day, it was tough yet enough to take home. Still, the best thing they built was not by their hands, but the foundation for those yet to come. For better or worse, and we've seen much of both after a century, I'm still proud to say that they helped to make Motown. Motown helped to make me. With so many places to play, there was Olympia and Orchestra Hall and Motown's famed Studio A. He had midnight sessions and chart-topping sides, the horn that you hear on Grapevine. From Marvin to Stevie, the Supremes and the Tops, it was one grooving assembly line. For better or worse, and we've seen much of both after a century, I'm still proud to say that they helped to make Motown. Motown helped to make me. Sometimes I feel like the unlikely child of Henry Ford and Aretha Franklin. For better or worse, and we've seen much of both after a century, I'm still proud to say that they helped to make Motown. Motown helped to make me. For better or worse, and we've seen much of both after a century, I'm still proud to say that they helped to make Motown. Motown helped to make me. I'm still proud to say that they helped to make Motown. Motown helped to make me.
Jeff Karub on Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Jeff's been playing for us all hour on the program. Last fall, Jeff's Coming Home to Music project was awarded a Knight Foundation grant to put on a series of house concerts in Detroit, and he joins us now to tell us about it. Welcome. You've been sounding great.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
You have a nice guitar there. Made by Motown is all about Michigan and Detroit. Are your other songs as Michigan-centric as that one?
maybe not so upfront, not so literally.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't help where you're from. This is the state I'm from, and that's the city I grew up around. But no, that really is the most, I think, personal and direct piece of writing, songwriting, that I've done, where I really am doing something that's approaching 100% true, autobiographical and all that.
Yeah. How long did it take to create that song?
Well, you know, every song is different. It's like a baby. Every baby's different. There are no favorites. But that one actually kind of wrote itself backwards. I thought of the line of being an unlikely child of Aretha Franklin and Henry Ford for a lot of reasons. And I kind of wrote it backwards. And that happens sometimes too. With that one, you know, part of the verse came first. Sometimes a chorus will come first. But once I got that idea and said, okay, now I think I can tell this story that goes from my grandfather's generation to my father's generation to me, it really went very quickly.
Uh-huh. How? Tell us about the Coming Home Music Project. What's your vision for that?
Well, there are house concerts happening all over the city, the state, and the country. It's not something widely known, but I think it's growing in acceptance. What I really want to do there is expose more people to the homegrown music of Detroit or music from elsewhere being played in Detroit. House concerts, that's where music began, but we kind of have gotten away from that. We think that, you know, the best place to play is a place with the biggest marquee. But the reality is there's lots of great music. I don't need to tell you, it's no secret. There's been a lot of great music of all genres coming out of Detroit. And I like the idea of democratizing the process and putting these concerts in a rotating series of homes where you don't need to have room for 100. You don't need a grand ballroom. What you need is a living room that can fit 20 to 30 people. I've done these shows. I've played these shows, and they work.
How will you choose the artists who perform?
Well, the great thing about this is they're coming to me. Now, I will do my own homework. I'm a journalist by day. I do research. But I've already heard from people. There's a great jazz artist in the Detroit area who's already approached me. There's a duo that is Bay Area-based now, but the woman in the duo comes from Lansing. So I'm hoping to get her involved. There are spoken word artists in Detroit. There are jazz, classical, folk artists. I know a lot of them because I play with them or open for them. So we're already, even though the first concert won't be until September, we already have people who have stepped up to offer to host the concert and also to play.
How is it these have become so much more prevalent in recent years? House concerts, I mean.
Well, there's probably myriad reasons for it. I can say one reason has to be that as the business of music, the music industry has changed. I think people are looking for something a little more authentic, something a little more organic. You know, as we move toward this world of social media and the 24-hour information age, there's something that is lacking in music, and that's the direct connection, the intimate connection with an audience. And I really applaud the Knight Foundation for recognizing that putting concerts in homes may not be revolutionary or huge, but it's a small thing that catches fire and grows. And there's, to me, I think once you attend a house concert, you see the magic. And there's not a single house concert that someone in that audience doesn't say, "This is awesome. I've never been here. This is awesome. I want to host one."
Well, talk about the ultimate intimacy, though. I mean, that's probably the charm of the whole thing. Does a house concert always have to be in somebody's home?
No. I mean, by definition, it probably should be. But I've done lots of house-style concerts. And sometimes people say, you know what, I know I could do 20 people in my room, but I want to have this in my church, not in the sanctuary, but in the parlor. I've done parlor concerts in churches, like my church, Dearborn First United Methodist Church. So by definition, it doesn't have to be, but there's sort of you want to make sure you have that vibe, that intimacy, that informality, that idea that, you know, you're not sitting on your hands, you're listening, you're interacting without heckling.
Mm-hmm. What do you want to avoid when hosting a house concert?
Well, if you normally sit around your house in your underwear, I'd rather that you didn't for these shows.
Make sure the toilets work. Yes.
Right.
Okay.
And how should the toilet paper be? Should it be? I've been married for 18 years. I don't remember how to do that. But I always put the seat down. Anyway, you want to realize that, yes, it's informal, and yes, it's in someone's home. But, you know, turn off the big screen TV. If you want this to be a party, start the party after the concert. You know, we want to have it. We want to keep this fun. This is sort of the spirit of house concerts. But you also want to remember that you came to hear some good music that you may have never heard before.
You'll receive $8,000 from the Knight Foundation to put this on, but you need to match the funds first. Where are you with that goal?
Well, I think we're about a quarter of the way there, and we've only just put this out through informal channels. You know, I've mentioned it to friends and family. I've put things on the Coming Home to Music Facebook page. People can find it, Coming Home to Music. But we want to ramp this up now that the new year is upon us. We have until September to match that $8,000. So we plan to have some donor concerts. We plan to do a Kickstarter or another crowdfunded campaign because those are popular these days. I just don't think that should be your only method of fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sense in thinking that there's one good way to do this. Just talking about it and promoting it with people, it really does catch people by surprise.
Tell us about your musical background exactly.
Well, I started playing violin before I can remember. I was 3. And I actually started at the Detroit Community Music School, which no longer exists. It was in the Cass Quarter. But music is in my blood. It's in my genes, as you can hear from the song made by Motown. My father is a classical French horn player, still alive and kicking and playing at 83. But he played with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and he played on many, many Motown records when they were recording in their Detroit heyday. So it's in the blood. And I picked up instrument after instrument, and I guess I keep trying until I get it right.
Well, you're a great mandolin player and guitar player. You've got a new collection of songs, or a recent collection of songs, that's just out. You're going to play us out with a track from that. What are we going to hear here?
This is from my upcoming EP, or short CD. The CD is called Find a Shore, and this song is called And We Go.
And We Go. Jeff Karub on Current State.
The world will little note, nor long remember what we say here. But you never know what long ago words will linger or disappear. An old address, watch time compress. No way to know just what survives. A cosmic coin flips on and on. Faith of fate.
I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us for Current State on WKAR. Have a great weekend.
And we go. And we go. Take a breath, say a prayer, be prepared for something we just don't know. Gotta find some kind of divine intervention.